Simon Musto is an ecologist, artist, expedition leader, and naturalist. His new book is called How to Survive the Next 100 Years, Lessons from Nature. Hello, Simon.
Hello. Hi, Trevor. How are you?
Well, Simon, can we look positively towards the next 100 years?
We can, of course. And we have to, of course, do it, don't we, Trevor? Because if we're not positive about something, how can we actually do anything about it anyway?
Is it unrealistic, though, because you know how people say looking through rose-coloured glasses, can we realistically take a look at that and see how there is a way forward, given that we see so much stuff about animal extinction, so much stuff about climate change? Can we realistically do that?
Well, so this was kind of my challenge, I guess, because obviously as an ecologist, and like so many other people out there, I'm overwhelmed by the amount of negative news that we receive all of the time. And there is one of the questions that you have to ask yourself as a scientist is the information you're gathering, if you're doing experiments, for example, is it biased? And so what I did, I guess, personally was set myself a challenge of sort of clearing the board, starting again and just building things up from the ground and wondering that very question myself. And as you start to do that, as you start to ignore what you're receiving just sort of generally daily from social media and so on, for instance, I mean, the words climate change, I don't think there's a day in the last 15 years where I haven't heard that terminology. So we know about it, but perhaps the amount of information we're receiving about all of these things added together, the question we have to ask ourselves is it real? Is it balanced? I should say, so of course it's real, but is it balanced, you know, with everything else? And I think when you start to do that, when you start to scrape the surface, you realize that maybe there is this other side of the story. Things that don't get reported, things that don't get studied, for example. So one of the findings is that there's the WWF Living Planet Index that comes out every few years, which is an amazing piece of work, but has repeatedly claimed that 3/4 of animals in the world are declining. In actual fact, there's serious analytical bias in that study, and a paper found very recently that the figures are close to half the animals going up and half going down. So when I stand in front of people and I talk about this, I say, well, if you have your pantry in your kitchen with half the food increasing, well, half of it decreases, right? It's not a perfect scenario. You might run out of flour or eggs, but you still have food to eat, okay? So you've got something to work with. A very different story to 3/4 of animals declining. So I think when you start to look at this story in a more pragmatic way, and you kind of search a bit more actively for a broader base of knowledge, you realize that there is real hope. There are genuine things happening in the world that we can grab hold of that offer us a great deal more optimism. And the thing that excites me most of all is much of what that means is accessible and available to local communities to do themselves.
And it's such a wonderful thing to be able to take a look at ways, especially with local communities, that we can do that and we can do our own bit. Does, though, within that, the things that we can do within our local communities and the things that we do individually, can those things outweigh the things that are done by larger groups like mining companies, like other things that are actually causing the issues to do with climate change?
Well, we have to address both, of course. So there's a need to keep the pressure upon our leaders and others to start to transform the way that our economies work into becoming more nature-centered. That's a different story, of course. It's not one I've been writing about. There's a gap for writing about. But yes, no, absolutely. We can't keep the pressure off that. But what I think I find, and this is a very personal thing as well for me, is a lot of the narrative around the environment and ecology particularly is very disempowering because you can't do a lot about what you're hearing about on the news, right? But you can do things in your local area. And probably the most exciting part of this is it starts with, or I say, rewilding the mind. So it's a hard concept to describe in just a few minutes, but the way that we interact with nature, because we are animals and we effectively are brains that float around, disconnected physically from the world, is through our mind And when we corrupt the way that we connect with it, we get anxious, and that leads to all manner of issues like anxiety, stress, obesity, heart disease, and so on. And that by reconnecting with nature, which is really just a matter of looking at it, immersing oneself within it, you can begin to alter the way that you think. And interestingly, altering the way we think is probably the first and greatest step in changing the way we behave, and our planet's outcomes will improve as a result of that, because we'll start making more logical, wiser decisions. It sounds whimsical, but there's actually some very strong evidence for this, both within mental health and also within movements like the Rights of Nature movements. And as I mentioned earlier, this is about unlocking some of the most important pathways for our own economic gain resilience that are available to communities to do themselves if they just change the way they think slightly and behave in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound whimsical, but however, the thing is, though, that when you look at that, it means that if we change our attitudes and we think in a different way, then it will not only change the attitudes of how we feel about the environment, but it will then change our attitudes to the things that we do to the environment and with it, which can then lead to bigger things.
That's right. And I like to say we become the change in a way. And you've got to remember, I guess, Trevor, that we are animals, right? So we're also the most dominant animal in the landscape. And for better or worse, or whatever you might think, that's the way the planet has made us, right? And so we are both nature's natural destroyers and creators, and all animals are. In fact, everything we do destroys something a little bit, but we also use waste, other things create to also create. And the waste we make enables other animals to create things. And so in theory, when you've got systems in balance, everything is working together, then the sort of creation and destruction cancels each other out. And then I guess the predicament we have today is that we've drawn out all of those natural services that would have provided that. And so we can work together to kind of get that back. And what fascinates me a lot as well is how much, go back to the question about half the animals increasing. There are a lot of species of animal that are actually doing quite well. We tend to call them pests sometimes, okay, which is kind of odd. I mean, it's an inconvenience, yes, but there are also animals that are kind of bouncing back. They're making good on some of the destruction that we're creating. And there are also animals coming back of their own volition, like whales, like humpback whales in Australia, for instance, that are doing tremendously well and are recreating enormous natural processes. And we hardly know about that. No one's really researched it because, of course, it's never happened before. We live at a time when perhaps more positive change is happening as well as negative change, I guess what I'm saying. And we tend to ignore the positive change because it's never occurred. So we've not really got a living memory of that. So research doesn't really look at it. And because of its complexity and the way systems work, it's a very hard thing for people to get their head around. The best way to do that really is to just immerse oneself in nature again. And as I say, that anxiety sort of disappears. And then the cycle of destruction starts to turn into a cycle of restoration again.
How do you then, though, take those positive stories as you take a look at where the animals that have been considered to be extinct or heading towards extinction are now doing well, in comparison to the fact, though, that there are so many animals that have become extinct and also are on the verge of extinction? So how do you actually make the positives join to the negatives and create change that way?
So again, I would say you look for the examples of where there's been a positive outcome. So one classic case in Australia is the eastern barred bandicoot on mainland Australia. Now that was an animal that was considered extinct in the 1980s and was found just a handful of animals were found living in abandoned cars in a quarry in Hamilton in Western Victoria. Of things. Those animals were rescued, wind forward 40 years, and there are thousands and thousands of them because they were bred in a predator-proof sanctuary initially by John Walmsley and now by the Odinars Foundation. That species has been reintroduced recently to a working sheep farm in Western Victoria, and in just 3 years has increased the profitability of that farm by recreating soil processes. Not only that, it's reduced flood risk it's reduced the risk of fences being knocked over by floods because the burrows and the furrows of the animals create absorb moisture better. It's almost eradicated weed management issues. So we spend $3.5 to $4.5 billion a year in Australia on weed pest management. After the recent Queensland floods, $80 million was estimated as needed just to rebuild fences. So a single animal, which we've brought back from extinction quite easily, okay, by just removing threats, is enabling those kinds of problems to go away. And that's happening on a small scale right now, but it is beginning to grow around. There's a lot of motivation to grow those kinds of processes around Australia. So the more that landowners and councils and everyone can get behind these sort of processes, the quicker we can actually just re-stitch together all of our landscape processes, and we'll start to see a lot of those problems decline, and we'll build that sort of economic resilience that we really need going forward in the next 100 years.
Just a couple of texts that have come in. One saying, is this gentleman saying we can now embrace animal extinction and animal extinction denial?
Well, see, this is an interesting thing, right? So whenever the hardest thing about talking positively about the environment, Trevor, is that as soon as you talk positively about it, you get attacks about why are you not talking negatively? And this is something perhaps for another discussion, but it's bedded in eco-anxiety, which is a form of trauma, and we all suffer it, right? And trauma is a really, really difficult thing to overcome because it uses parts of our nervous systems that we're not entirely in control of, and it's caused by access and constantly being exposed to these messages. No one's saying that we don't have problems. What I'm saying is that in focusing our minds and our bodies entirely on the difficulties and thinking that that's an overwhelming issue that's never going to go away and we can't do anything about it is truly disempowering. So yes, there's always going to be skeptics out there, but that's not the point. The majority of people believe wholeheartedly that we have an issue with biodiversity, climate, and so on. But what they really want to know is, what can we do about it? And that's it. Turn that feeling of disempowerment into something that actually makes change. And as I mentioned, there are many examples when you care to actually look for it. Many thousands and thousands of examples, almost every location we live in, where things are also turning around and going in the other direction. So if we took lessons from that, that would help us a great deal more in motivating us actually to do something different than taking all of our lessons from just what we hear about decline and destruction.
And is part of that saying, okay, look, we have stuffed up. We've stuffed up badly with our environment. We recognise that. Now, instead of just complaining about what we've done, we need to take a very good look at what we can do to create change in the future.
Yeah, I believe so. And I also think it's about not apportioning blame either. I mean, obviously I'm an ardent nature lover, and I could be considered a greenie and environmentalist, but at the end of the day, I've also benefited enormously from this amazing society that we have, right? So for the last 50 years, we've developed some extraordinary technology and an economy that served us really, really well. I like to describe the sort of the boomer period of the 1950s, obviously 50 years ago. I was sitting in front of a group in Rotary the other day saying, you guys, you're out there in your open top sports cars, heading down the beach, having fun. I said, a lot of that value you were getting was coming from nature, right? And they all agreed. Like we've frittered a lot of that away now. And so we've developed these systems to live in, which were really fit for purpose 50 years ago. They're not quite so fit for purpose today. So one of the challenges is to actually kind of unpick that, which takes a bit of time, and recreate new ways of living that is in more accordance with the problems we have today, and to enable the rich tapestry of natural processes, which are driven by wildlife, to come back into being and really lift us and support us once more again, so that the next 50 years we can actually spend rebuilding. And I think it's a really exciting time. It's an exciting time to be alive, because I've been looking at this for my entire life, and I have never lived at a time when there's been so many people concerned and motivated to change. It's truly amazing.
Within that, there's a need, if we can create change and we have beliefs that we can create change. And as you're saying, there are examples of change happening at the moment as far as animals are concerned and environment is concerned. We need to have government supporting the individuals and supporting the communities that are wanting to create that change.
That's right. And so I'm running a project at the moment, for example, in Melbourne, where we're doing community co-design to create a community stewardship plan for actions to protect the local marine environment here. And the first thing we do in those instances is we have what's called an intergovernmental meeting. So we'll talk to government, but we're not talking to government to ask them for their advice at this stage. What we're talking to them about is to say, what do you need from us? Okay. And then for the next months or year or so, we go away and we work with the community to develop the tools and resources and pull the knowledge from within our community to then provide the government with a solution. The solution actually comes from us, because government's not looking for people to shout at it and say, I need you to tell me what to do. Government wants the community to come up with its ideas and support that. It's a far stronger position to be in. So, again, we have to sort of change this paradigm slightly and get people to think a little bit differently. If we can give communities the chance to be part of their own self-determined future and have the tools and understanding to take lessons from nature in doing that, then we can re-empower our government also to make the right decisions. And I would think most policymakers would prefer that as an option, and I think most people would understand that's a slightly better way to do it than just constantly turning up and shouting at people to do more, when in fact we don't know what that is.
An example of that in some ways has also been with forestry in certain parts of Australia, where the people who are involved in the forestry industry have worked with people who are involved with the environment to take a look at going back to things like selective felling within forestry areas and not just clear felling. So it's not as if industry and environmentalists can't work together as well.
No, it isn't. And we have to be a little bit nuanced in our approach to this. So there's an example for Western Victoria, recently, you're probably aware, culled a large number of koalas. It's an interesting situation because the blue gum plantation owners are effectively, have been singled out as the main cause of the issue. Well, actually, they're not the cause of the issue at all. They are a consequence, or their impact on their industry is a consequence of mismanagement of koalas for decades. Okay, so imagine you've got a landscape where there's not much koala vegetation left. Okay, so that again served us well. 50 years, for whatever reason, we've done things to degrade the local environment, and koalas have suffered as a result of it. And we didn't really think a lot about that for a long time. And then all of a sudden, we find that, oh, there's a market for blue gums. The market for blue gums doing quite well in Victoria, so they start planting blue gums. Now, blue gums grow quite fast. Turns out the koalas really like to eat them. Okay. Now, if something that eats blue gum is endangered and it likes to eat it, there is a certain positive in that, right? Perhaps we could think about using that in some way at some stage. But the point is that the blue gum plantation owners are almost a circumstantial situation. They find themselves in a situation where they're actually attracting the koalas that can't feed elsewhere because of a problem we caused. But now, today, they are almost singly responsible for paying for koala landscape scale management, and they're made to be the enemies, but they're not really the cause of the problem in the first place. And I think if we turn that around, and again, I think this is where local community-led programs are really important, because Melbourne policymakers, unis, people sitting outside of that industry beyond the local community, I think can do more damage than good sometimes by coming in over the top and with their ideas about how to solve things, when actually a grassroots initiative with the local community and their own local industry, because they live in the same places, right? They know these people, can sometimes result in surprisingly more elegant solutions. Because at the end of the day, most people would like to see koalas survive. Okay.
We're joined this morning by Simon Musto, ecologist, artist, expedition leader, naturalist, and also the author of a book called How to Survive the Next 100 Years, Lessons from Nature, which is significant. If you want to join us, you can give us a ring, 1-300-800-222.
On the ABC Listen app, hear the latest true crime podcasts. Binge the full investigation on Someone Knows Something, Unravel, and Mushroom Case Daily. True crime on the ABC Listen app.
One of the texts I've got in front of me, Simon, says Mulligan's Flat in Canberra is a 2.5 square kilometre sanctuary, which has no introduced species, e.g. foxes, rabbits, deer, etc. They have betongs and quills and all manner of native flora and fauna. It's spectacular, it says here. So when you take that, which is such a good story, Simon, how do you then elaborate on that? Or do you need to? Do you need to make it bigger? Or do you take a look at what they've done and then take another 12.5 kilometres and another 12.5 kilometres?
Well, okay, so it's fascinating what's happening at the moment. I might just point out, actually, that one of the things we don't do very well, Trevor, of course, is tell these stories, right? So there's actually a lot of the best examples of what's happening and the wins that we're getting that could be scaled up never reach the news, okay? The people who are doing it usually, and I know a lot of them, are incredible people. They're also so hardworking, so under-resourced. They don't have the time to go out and boast about what they're up to, right? And so it takes maybe 20 years before you start seeing the outcomes. Now, Mulligan's Flat is taking, I understand, taking some of the learnings from the place I mentioned earlier that rebuilt the populations of Eastern Bandicoot. Mm. Okay. And what is beginning to happen now? So you've got the fence sanctuaries, which obviously, you know, you go, your mind's immediately going to, how can we do this? I'm sure your listeners are already thinking this through, right? And this is where, again, community co-design is really important, because often when you empower the community with the possibility, they come up with crazy ideas that actually will work, okay, that governments can't necessarily resource. So you've got these fence sanctuaries, and in Victoria now we have even private landowners trying to do it themselves, okay? And so the idea is like, okay, how can we connect these together and grow it? Now, if everybody wants to do it, we probably solve this problem quite quickly. But one of the things they've been looking at recently is the use of, so rather than poisoning animals like foxes and cats, what they're trying to look at is what happens if we just make them feel a bit ill, okay, if we associate that feeling with the native animals. And we're in early stages of this design. But behind that is the philosophy that when Europeans first settled Australia, we destroyed a lot of the environment. We cut down most of the forest. Here in Melbourne, where I live, I used to live in the Dandenong Ranges. There are pictures from, you know, 100, 120 years ago, where the places that are now forested, where you just assume, oh, there's always been forest here, were completely clear felt. There was nothing left, right, other than just grass. So pretty much all the animals were just removed from that landscape. And of course, if you reintroduce European-style predators into that landscape, they do fantastically well, especially with rabbits, right? So you're effectively putting a broom through the entire system. So one of the logics is, well, if we then enable regrowing the native vegetation whilst buying the animals time to repatriate those areas, then maybe we might find we can strike a new balance, even with predators in the landscape. No one's actually tried this before, and this is the thing about nature restoration. We're averse to sort of trying to take these risks. Until we actually give it a go, we don't know. And in a lot of cases, animals surprise us by being actually quite resilient. And you just look at some of these sanctuaries, the rate at which these animals are breeding. The Australian landscape must have been an incredible place before this happened, because the density of animals in places like Mulligan's Flat is almost beyond belief. Okay. In fact, if we had that density in the landscape today, we'd be causing some of those animals pests. In actual fact, they might actually be a functioning part of that system that can do things such as increase farm profitability. So I think we have to just open our minds a little bit, just free ourselves up to the possibilities that this might actually be something that could happen. And if we resource it to us, not even a huge degree, we can potentially create some almost unimaginable possibilities for restoring our landscapes.
There's an incredible story about what happened at Yellowstone National Park when they reintroduced wolves to the environment and what changes the introduction of wolves made. It cut down on the number of deer, which meant that then the environment, as far as fauna was concerned, native fauna started to regrow, and it actually changed the whole environment, which is, I guess, a little bit of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I love that story because it has a couple of twists to it as well. So what, of course, occurred, as you described, is the rivers actually changed their course. And so for years after that, scientists have been going, well, is this a good or bad thing, right? And they can't agree. Some people are saying, it's not a good thing for the environment. It's caused problems for our economy. Other people have said, no, it's brilliant. Just recently, a paper came out where the scientists effectively concluded that their lifetime wouldn't be enough to understand what's going on. And this is a really cathartic thing for me, and I think it's the first step in any discussion I have with people about nature is, like it or hate it, we will never understand how these systems work. So we have a choice to make now. We have a choice whether we allow nature to lead us or whether we continue to try to hold it back. So for instance, if we introduced we did a project to restore native animals back into the Australian landscape, and that caused a creek to be created or even recreate it that was there many years ago. And that creek happened to flow across a piece of farmland where someone was making a profit from subsequently growing something else. We have a decision to make, right? Do we then culvert that creek and move it away like we have done in the past, recreating all the same problems? Or do we allow it to go through and somehow work with that landowner, compensate or whatever, to enable that natural process to occur, to sort of sail with the wind, if you like? And I think we have to move into more of a mindset where we go, let's not worry about whether it's inconvenience to us now. Let's give nature the chance to show us the way, to lead in the way it knows, and just try to fit around that so that we can maintain those natural processes that, according to the best global studies at the moment, if we allow that to happen, could, for every dollar spent, be putting $7 to $30 back into our local economies, money that's not available now to us, that the governments are actually struggling to get a dollar return now from what we pay as taxpayers, because we've frittered away so much of the supporting services from nature that we're now effectively paying for to recreate nature, if you like. You know, everything from flood defense, seawalls, to you name it, every year our cost of living goes up more and more because we're spending more and more money on trying to hold nature to account. And we could just be going, oh, you know what, why don't we just let nature show what they can do for us for free and then enjoy all of those aspects that we had 50 years ago where we could just freely go out into nature in and feel guiltless about it because we're part of it again.
If people are interested in that Yellowstone story, you look it up because it's an interesting story. And just for someone said, but what about the farmers? We should point out that there was compensation for farmers if they could prove that their stock was actually taken by the wolves that were then reintroduced. I've got a text here that says, my money is with David Suzuki, said 50 years ago, without an environment, we don't have an economy, but politicians seem to only focus on the economy. And I also think of another David Suzuki book, Simon, called Wisdom of the Elders, where we start to go back and take a look at what older civilizations and what older groups of people, whether it be Indigenous peoples from countries, then have a feeling about and what they believe should be done with the environment as well.
Or the older people within our own communities. We do have people that are very wise that we don't talk to who are our elders and know these things as well, Trevor. And landowners, you mentioned earlier, landowners are incredibly important. And this is all about that. And there'll be a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, who are landowners who would love to do more and would just want that support to do it, right? And they feel embattled. They feel like they're being blamed when they just want to do more. So how do we help landowners to help us? How do we help the animals to help the landowners? It's all part of that question.
And it's what you're talking about, I guess, is that it's true consultation. It's true consultation with our communities. It's true consultation with our elders, the people that know the areas that are perhaps in trouble, and then taking that consultation, and as long as it's real consultation, to government and saying these are things we can do.
Well, yeah, so I don't like the word consultation. We use the word conversation because out of conversations come answers. And so there's a book I will reference, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams.
Yes.
I don't know if anyone of your listeners have read it, but one of the most important conservation books ever written. Deep Thought, which has given 7.5 million years to answer the question of life, the universe, and everything, simply says, 42. And the scientists are aghast. What do you mean? And Deep Thought says, well, you haven't asked the right question. When he says, the answer will come once you know the answer, the question will appear to you. When you allow communities to have their own conversations and you enable that learning together, what happens is answers reveal themselves before, first. And then the question comes, how can we do that? How can we engage that possibility and make that happen? And so we have it the wrong way round, okay? And so, yeah, conversations with local communities, thousands of people with incredible intellects who know how to make this change if you just resource them and give them the chance to learn from each other, not coming over the top and tell them what to do or say, I know better than you, I'm cleverer than you. What can you do? What do you understand about where you live? And that's the approach we take. It's the absolute pinnacle, actually, of conservation. And it's very rarely done in Australia because we have this sort of almost post-colonial attitude which we apply to our own civilization. And we just assume everyone else knows better and we let people come in and make the decisions for us.
Look forward to hearing more about those conversations and the outcomes of those conversations, Simon. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a delight. Cheers.
Simon Mustoe, ecologist, artist, expedition leader, naturalist, and the author of a book that says, How to Survive the Next 100 Years, Lessons from Nature, and lessons from the community and the people that probably know an awful lot about it as well.